Part 2. March 1824. 4 years later. Chapter 5. You would enjoy it here. Not the heat, I should think. No one seems to enjoy the heat. But the rest would enchant you. The colours, the spices, the scent of the air. They can place one in a strange, sensuous haze that is at turns unsettling and intoxicating. Most of all, I think you would enjoy the pleasure gardens. They are rather like our London parks, except far more green and lush, and full of the most remarkable flowers you have ever seen. You have always loved to be out among nature. This you would adore, I am quite sure of it. From Michael Stirling, the new Earl of Kilmartin, to the Countess of Kilmartin, 1 month after his arrival in India. Francesca wanted a baby. She had for quite some time, but it was only in recent months that she'd been able to admit as much to herself, to finally put words to the sense of longing that seemed to accompany her wherever she went. It had started innocently enough, with a little pang in her heart, upon reading a letter from her brother's wife Kate, the missive filled with news of their little girl Charlotte, soon to turn two, and already incorrigible. But the pang had grown worse, into something more akin to an ache, when her sister Daphne had arrived in Scotland for a visit, all four of her children in tow. It hadn't occurred to Francesca just how completely a gaggle of children could transform a home. The Hastings children had altered the very essence of Kilmartin, brought it to life and laughter that Francesca realised had been sadly lacking for years. And then they left, and all was quiet. But it wasn't peaceful, just empty. From that moment on, Francesca was different. She saw a nursemaid pushing a pram, and her heart ached. She spied a rabbit hopping across a field, and couldn't help but think that she ought to be pointing it out to someone else, someone small. She travelled to Kent to spend Christmas with her family, but when night fell and all of her nieces and nephews were tucked into bed, she felt too alone, and all she could think was that her life was passing her by, and if she didn't do something soon, she'd die this way. Alone. Not unhappy. She wasn't that. Strangely enough, she'd grown into her widowhood and found a comfortable and contented pattern to her life. It was something she never would have believed possible during the awful months immediately following John's death. But she had, a bit through trial and error, found a place for herself in the world, and with it, a small measure of peace. She enjoyed her life as Countess of Kilmartin. Michael had never married, so she retained the duties as well as the title. She loved Kilmartin, and she ran it with no interference from Michael. His instructions upon leaving the country 4 years earlier had been that she should manage the earldom as she saw fit, and once the shock of his departure had worn off, she'd realised that that had been the most precious gift he could have bestowed upon her. It had given her something to do, something to work toward, a reason to stop staring at the ceiling. She had friends, and she had family, both Stirling and Bridgerton, and she had a full life, in Scotland and London, where she spent several months of each year. So she should have been happy. And she was, mostly. She just wanted a baby. It had taken some time to admit this to herself. It was a desire that seemed somewhat disloyal to John. It wouldn't be his baby, after all. And even now, with him gone 4 years, it was difficult to imagine a child without his features woven across its face. And it meant, first and foremost, that she'd have to remarry. She'd have to change her name and pledge her troth to another man, to vow to make him first in her heart and her loyalties. And while the thought of that no longer struck pain in her heart, it seemed, well, strange. But she supposed there were some things a woman simply had to get past, and one cold February day, as she was staring out a window at Kilmartin, watching the snow slowly wrap a shroud around the tree branches, She realized that this was one of them. There were a lot of things in life to be afraid of, but strangeness ought not be among them. And so she decided to pack her things and head down to London a bit early this year. She generally spent the season in town, enjoying time with her family, shopping and attending musicales, taking in plays and doing all the things that simply weren't available in the Scottish countryside. But this season would be different. She needed a new wardrobe for one. She'd been out of mourning for some time, but she hadn't completely shrugged off the greys and lavenders of half mourning, and she certainly hadn't paid the attention to fashion that a woman in her new position ought. It was time to wear blue. Bright, beautiful cornflower blue. It had been her favourite colour years ago, and she'd been vain enough that she'd worn it fully expecting people to comment on how it matched her eyes. She'd buy blue, and yes, pink and yellow as well, and maybe even, something in her heart shivered with anticipation at the thought, crimson. She wasn't an unmarried miss this time around. She was an eligible widow, and the rules were different. But the aspirations were the same. She was going to London to find herself a husband. It had been too long. Michael knew that his return to Britain was well overdue, but it had been one of those things that was appallingly easy to put off. According to his mother's letters, which had found him with remarkable regularity, the earldom was thriving under Francesca's stewardship. He had no dependents who might accuse him of neglect, and by all accounts, everyone he'd left behind was faring rather better in his absence than they had when he'd been around to cheer them on. So there was nothing to feel guilty about. But a man could only run from his destiny for so long, and as he marked his third year in the tropics, he had to admit that the novelty of an exotic life had worn off, and, to be completely frank, he was growing rather sick of the climate. India had given him a purpose, a place in life that went beyond the only two things at which he'd ever excelled, soldiering and making merry. He'd boarded a ship with nothing but the name of an army friend who'd moved to Madras 3 years earlier. Within a month, he'd obtained a governmental post and found himself making decisions that mattered, implementing laws and policies that actually shaped the lives of men. For the first time, Michael finally understood why John had been so enamoured of his work in the British Parliament. But India hadn't made him happy. It had given him a small measure of peace, which seemed rather paradoxical, since in the past few years he'd nearly met his demise 3 times. 4, if one counted that run-in with the knife-wielding Indian princess. Michael still maintained that he could have disarmed her without injury, but she did, he had to admit, have a rather murderous look in her eye, and he'd long since learned that one should never, ever underestimate a woman who believes, however erroneously, herself scorned. Life-threatening episodes aside, however, his time in India had brought him a certain sense of balance. He'd finally done something for himself, made something of himself. But most of all, India had brought him peace because he didn't have to live with the constant knowledge that Francesca was just around the corner. Life wasn't necessarily better with thousands of miles between him and Francesca, but it certainly was easier. It was past time, however, to face up to the rigours of having her in close proximity. And so he'd packed up his belongings, informed his rather relieved valet that they were going back to England, booked a luxurious starboard suite on the Princess Amelia, and headed home. He'd have to face her, of course. There was no escaping that. He would have to look into the blue eyes that had haunted him relentlessly and try to be her friend. It was the one thing she'd wanted during the dark days after John's death, and it had been the only thing he had been completely unable to do for her. But maybe now, with the benefit of time and the healing power of distance, he could manage it. He wasn't stupid enough to hope that she'd changed, that he'd see her and discover he no longer loved her, That, he was quite certain, would never happen. But Michael had finally grown used to hearing the words Earl of Kilmartin without looking over his shoulder for his cousin. And maybe now, with the grief no longer so raw, he could be with Francesca in friendship, without feeling as if he were a thief, plotting to steal what he'd coveted for so long. And hopefully she, too, had moved on, and wouldn't ask him to fulfil John's duties in every way but one. But all the same, he was glad that it would be March when he disembarked in London, too early in the year for Francesca to have arrived for the season. He was a brave man. He'd proven that countless times, on and off the battlefield. But he was an honest man, too. Honest enough to admit that the prospect of facing Francesca was terrifying in a way that no French battlefield or toothy tiger could ever be. Maybe, if he was lucky, she'd choose not to come down to London for the season at all. Wouldn't that be a boon? It was dark, and she couldn't sleep, and the house was miserably cold, and the worst of it was all her fault. Oh, very well, not the dark. Francesca supposed she couldn't take the blame for that. Night was night, after all, and she was rather overreaching to think that she had anything to do with the sun going down. But it was her fault that the household hadn't been given adequate time to prepare for her arrival. She'd forgotten to send notice that she was planning to come down to London a month early, and, as a result, Kilmartin House was still running with a skeleton staff, and the stores of coal and beeswax candles were perilously low. All would be better on the morrow, after the housekeeper and butler made a mad dash to the Bond Street shops. But for now, Francesca was shivering in her bed. It had been a miserably freezing day, with a blustery wind that made it far colder than was normal for early March. The housekeeper had attempted to move all the available coal to Francesca's grate, but, countess or no, she couldn't allow the rest of the household to freeze at her expense. Besides, the countess's bedchamber was immense, and it had always been difficult to heat properly unless the rest of the house was warm as well. The library. That was it. It was small and cosy, and if Francesca shut the door, a fire in its grate would keep the room nice and toasty. Furthermore, there was a settee on which she could lie. It was small, but then again, so was she, and it couldn't possibly be any worse than freezing to death in her bedroom. Her decision made, Francesca leapt out of bed and dashed through the cold night air to her nightrobe, which was lying across the back of a chair. It wasn't nearly warm enough. Francesca hadn't thought to need anything bulkier, but it was better than nothing. And, she thought rather stoically, beggars couldn't be choosers, especially when their toes were falling off with cold. She hurried downstairs, her heavy wool socks slipping and sliding on the polished steps. She tumbled down the last two, thankfully landing on her feet, then ran along the runner carpet to the library. "Fire! Fire! Fire!" she mumbled to herself. She'd ring for someone just as soon as she got to the library. They'd have a blaze roaring in no time. She'd regain feeling in her nose. Her fingertips would lose that sickly blue colour, and she pushed open the door. A short, staccato scream hurled itself across her lips. There was already a fire in the grate, and a man standing in front of it, idly warming his hands. Francesca reached wildly for something, anything that she might use as a weapon. And then he turned. "Michael?" He hadn't known she'd be in London. Damn it, he hadn't even considered that she might be in London. Not that it would have made any difference, but at least he'd have been prepared. He might have schooled his features into a saturnine smirk, or at the very least made sure that he was impeccably dressed and wholeheartedly immersed in his role as the unrecoverable rake. But no, there he was, just gaping at her, trying not to notice that she was wearing nothing but a dark crimson nightgown and dressing robe, so thin and sheer that he could see the outline of... He gulped. Don't look. Do not look.
Michael,
she whispered again.
Francesca,
he said, since he had to say something.
What are you doing here?
And that seemed to snap her into thought and motion.
What am I doing here?
She echoed.
I'm not the one who's meant to be in India. What are you doing here?
He shrugged carelessly.
Thought it was time to come home.
Couldn't you have written?
To you?
He asked, quirking a brow. It was, and was meant to be, a direct hit. She hadn't penned him a single letter during his travels. He had sent her 3 letters, but once it became apparent that she didn't plan to answer, he'd conducted the rest of his correspondence through his mother and John's.
To anyone,
she replied.
Someone would have been here to greet you.
You're here,
he pointed out. She scowled at him.
If we'd known you were coming, we would have readied the house for you.
He shrugged again. The motion seemed to embody the image he desperately needed to convey.
It's ready enough.
She hugged her arms to her body, effectively blocking his view of her breasts, which she had to concede was probably for the best.
Well, you might have written,
she finally said, her voice hanging sharp in the night air.
It would only have been courteous.
Francesca,
he said, turning slightly away from her, so that he could continue to rub his hands together by the fire.
Do you have any idea how long it takes for mail to reach London from India?
5 months,
she answered promptly.
4, if the winds are kind.
Damn it, she was right.
Be that as it may,
he said peevishly.
By the time I decided to return, there was little use in attempting forward notice. The letter would have gone out on the same ship I did.
Really? I thought the passenger vessels were slower than the ones that take the mail.
He sighed, glancing at her over his shoulder.
They all take the mail. And besides, does it really matter?
For a moment, he thought she would answer in the affirmative. But then she said quietly,
No, of course not. The important thing is that you're home. Your mother will be thrilled.
He turned away so that she wouldn't see his humourless smile.
Yes,
he murmured.
Of course.
And I...
She stopped, cleared her throat.
I am delighted to have you back as well.
She sounded as if she were trying very hard to convince herself of this, but Michael decided to play the gentleman for once and not point it out.
Are you cold?
He asked instead.
Not very,
she said.
You're lying.
Just a little.
He stepped to the side, making room for her closer to the fire. When he didn't hear her move toward him, he motioned toward the empty space with his hand.
I should go back to my room, she said.
For God's sake, Francesca, if you're cold, just come to the fire. I won't bite.
She gritted her teeth and stepped forward, joining him near the blaze. But she kept herself somewhat off to the side, maintaining a bit of distance between them.
You look well, she said.
As do you.
It's been a long time.
I know. 4 years, I believe.
Francesca swallowed, wishing this weren't so difficult. This was Michael, for heaven's sake. It wasn't supposed to be difficult. Yes, they'd parted badly, but that had been in the dark days immediately following John's death. They'd all been in pain then. Wounded animals, lashing out at anyone in their way. It was supposed to be different now. Heaven knew she'd thought of this moment often enough. Michael couldn't stay away forever. They'd all known that. But once her initial anger had passed, she'd rather hoped that when he did return, they'd be able to forget that anything unpleasant had ever passed between them, and be friends again. She needed that, more than she'd ever realized.
"Do you have any plans?"
she asked, mostly because the silence was too awful.
"For now, all I can think about is getting warm,"
he muttered. She smiled in spite of herself.
"It is exceptionally chilly for this time of year."
"'I'd forgotten how damnably cold it can be here,' he grumbled, rubbing his hands together briskly.
"'One would think you'd never escape the memory of a Scottish winter,'
Francesca murmured. He turned to her then, a wry smile tilting one corner of his mouth. He'd changed, she realized. Oh, there were the obvious differences, the ones everyone would notice. He was tan, quite scandalously so, and his hair, always midnight black, now sported a few odd strands of silver. But there was more. He held his mouth differently, more tightly, if that made any sense, and his smooth, lanky grace seemed to have gone missing. He had always seemed so at ease, so comfortable in his skin, but now he was taut, strained.
"'You'd think,' he murmured,
and she just looked at him blankly, having quite forgotten what he was replying to, until he added,
"'I came home because I couldn't stand the heat any longer, and now here I am, ready to perish from the cold.'
"'It will be spring soon,' she said.
"'Ah, yes, spring, with its merely frigid winds as opposed to the icy ones of winter.'
She laughed at that, absurdly pleased to have anything to laugh about in his presence.
"'The house will be better tomorrow,' she said. "'I only just arrived this evening, and like you, I neglected to send advance notice. "'Mrs. Parrish assures me that the house will be restocked tomorrow.'
He nodded, then turned around to warm his back.
"'What are you doing here?'
"'Me?'
He motioned to the empty room, as if to make a point.
"'I live here,' she said.
"'You usually don't come down until April.'
"'You know that?'
For a moment, he looked almost embarrassed.
"'My mother's letters are remarkably detailed,' he said.
She shrugged, then inched a little closer to the fire. She ought not stand so near to him. But dash it, she was still rather cold, and her thin nightrobe did little to ward off the chill.
"'Is that an answer?'
he drawled.
"'I just felt like it,' she said insolently. "'Isn't that a lady's prerogative?'
He turned again, presumably to warm his side, and then he was facing her, and he seemed terribly close. She moved, just an inch or so. She didn't want him to realize she'd been made uncomfortable by his nearness, nor did she want to admit the very same thing to herself.
"'I thought it was a lady's prerogative to change her mind,' he said.
"'It's a lady's prerogative to do anything she wants,' Francesca said pertly.
"'Touché,'
Michael murmured. He looked at her again, more closely this time.
"'You haven't changed.'
Her lips parted.
"'How can you say that?'
"'Because you look exactly as I remembered you.'
And then, devilishly, he motioned toward her revealing nightwear.
"'Aside from your attire, of course.'
She gasped and stepped back, wrapping her arms more tightly around her body. It was a bit sick of him, but he was rather pleased with himself for having offended her. He'd needed her to step away, to move out of his reach. She was going to have to set the boundaries, because he wasn't sure he'd prove up to the task. He'd been lying when he'd said she hadn't changed. There was something different about her. Something entirely unexpected. Something that shook him down to his very soul. It was a sense about her. All in his mind, really, but no less devastating. There was an air of availability, a horrible, torturous knowledge that John was gone, really, truly gone, and the only thing stopping Michael from reaching out and touching her was his own conscience. It was almost funny. Almost. And there she was, still without a clue, still completely unaware that the man standing next to her wanted nothing so much than to peel every layer of silk from her body and lay her down in front of the fire. He wanted to nudge her thighs apart, sink himself into her and... He laughed grimly. 4 years, it seemed, had done little to cool his inappropriate ardour.
Michael? He looked over at her. What's so funny?
Her question, that's what. You wouldn't understand.
Try me,
she dared.
Oh, I think not.
Michael,
she prodded. He turned to her and said with deliberate coolness,
Francesca, there are some things you will never understand.
Her lips parted, and for a moment she looked as if she'd been struck, and he felt as horrid as if he'd done so.
That was a terrible thing to say,
she whispered. He shrugged.
You've changed,
she said. The sad thing was, he hadn't. Not in any of the ways that might have made his life easier to bear. He sighed, hating himself, because he couldn't bear to have her hate him.
Forgive me,
he said, running his hand through his hair.
I'm tired, and I'm cold, and I'm an ass.
She grinned at that, and for a moment they were transported back in time.
It's all right,
she said kindly, touching his upper arm.
You've had a long journey.
He sucked in his breath. She used to do this all the time, touch his arm in friendship. Never in public, of course, and rarely, even when it had just been the two of them. John would have been there. John was always there, and it had always, always shaken him. But never so much as now.
I need to go to bed,
he mumbled. He was usually a master at hiding his unease, but he just hadn't been prepared to see her this evening, and beyond that, he was damned tired. She withdrew her hand.
There won't be a room ready for you. You should take mine. I'll sleep here.
No,
he said, with far more force than he'd intended.
I'll sleep here, or hell,
he muttered, striding across the room to yank on the bell pull. What the devil was the point of being the bloody Earl of Kilmartin if you couldn't have a bedchamber readied at any hour of the night? Besides, ringing the bell would mean that a servant would arrive within minutes, which would mean that he would no longer be standing here alone with Francesca. It wasn't as if they hadn't been alone together before, but never at night, and never with her in her nightgown, and he yanked the cord again.
Michael,
she said, sounding almost amused.
I'm sure they heard you the first time.
Yes, well, it's been a long day,
he said.
Storm in the Channel and all that.
You'll have to tell me if your travels soon,
she said gently. He looked over at her, lifting a brow.
I would have written to you of them.
Her lips pursed for a moment. It was an expression he'd seen countless times on her face. She was choosing her words, deciding whether or not to spear him with her legendary wit. And apparently she decided against it, because instead she said,
I was rather angry with you for leaving.
He sucked in his breath. Trust Francesca to choose stark honesty over a scathing retort.
I'm sorry,
he said, and he meant it, even though he wouldn't have changed any of his actions. He'd needed to leave. He'd had to leave. Maybe it meant he was a coward. Maybe it meant he'd been less of a man. But he hadn't been ready to be the Earl. He wasn't John. Could never be John. And that was the one thing everyone had seemed to want of him. Even Francesca, in her own halfway sort of manner. He looked at her. He was quite sure she still didn't understand why he'd left. She probably thought she did, but how could she? She didn't know that he loved her, couldn't possibly understand how damned guilty he felt at assuming John's life. But none of that was her fault. And as he looked at her, standing fragile and proud as she stared at the fire, he said it again.
I'm sorry.
She acknowledged his apology with the barest hint of a nod.
I should have written to you,
she said. She turned to him then, her eyes filled with sorrow, and perhaps a hint of their own apology.
But the truth was, I just didn't feel like it. Thinking of you made me think of John, and I suppose I needed not to think of him so much just then.
Michael didn't pretend to understand, but he nodded nonetheless. She smiled wistfully.
We had such fun, the three of us, didn't we?"
He nodded again. "I miss him," he said, and he was surprised by how good it felt to voice that.
"I always thought it would be so lovely when you finally married," Francesca added. "You would have chosen someone brilliant and fun, I'm sure. What grand times the four of us would have had."
Michael coughed. It seemed the best course of action. She looked up, broken from her reverie.
"Are you catching a chill?"
"Probably. I'll be at death's door by Saturday, I'm sure."
She arched a brow.
"I hope you don't expect me to nurse you."
Just the opening he needed to move their banter back to where he felt most comfortable.
"Not necessary," he said with a wave of his hand. "I shouldn't need more than 3 days to attract a bevy of unsuitable women to attend to my every need."
Her lips pinched slightly, but she was clearly amused.
"The same as ever, I see."
He gave her a lopsided grin.
"No one ever really changes, Francesca."
She cocked her head to the side, motioning to the hall, where they could hear someone moving toward them on swift feet. The footman arrived, and Francesca took care of everything, allowing Michael to do nothing but stand by the fire, looking vaguely imperial as he nodded his agreement.
"Good night, Michael,"
she said, once the footman had left to do her bidding.
"Good night, Francesca,"
he said softly.
"It's good to see you again,"
she said, and then, as if she needed to convince one of them of it, he wasn't sure which, she added,
"It truly is."
Chapter 6
"I'm sorry I haven't written. No, that's not true. I'm not sorry. I don't wish to write. I don't wish to think of..."
From the Countess of Kilmartin to the new Earl of Kilmartin, one day after the receipt of his first missive to her, torn to bits, then soaked with tears. By the time Michael arose the next morning, Kilmartin House seemed to be back up and running, as befitted the home of an earl. There were fires in every grate, and a splendid breakfast had been laid out in the informal dining room, with coddled eggs, ham, bacon, sausage, toast with butter and marmalade, and his own personal favourite, broiled mackerel. Francesca, however, was nowhere to be found. When he inquired after her, he was given a folded note she'd left for him earlier that morning. It seemed she felt that tongues might wag at their living alone together at Kilmartin House, and so she had removed herself to her mother's residence at No. 5 Bruton Street, until either Janet or Helen arrived down from Scotland. She did, however, invite him to call upon her that day, as she was certain they had much to discuss. And Michael supposed she was right. So once he'd finished with his breakfast, finding, much to his great surprise, that he rather missed the yogurts and doses of his Indian morning meal, he stepped outside and made his way to No. 5. He elected to walk. It wasn't very far, and the air had warmed appreciably since the icy gusts of the day before. But mostly, he just wanted to take in the cityscape, to remind himself of the rhythms of London. He'd never noticed the particular smells and sounds of the capital before. How the clip-clop of horses' hooves combined with the festive shout of the flower seller and low rumble of cultured voices. There was the sound of his feet on the pavement and smell of roasting nuts and the vague heft of soot in the air, all combining to make something that was uniquely London. It was almost overpowering, which was strange, because he remembered feeling precisely the same way upon landing in India 4 years earlier. The humid air, redolent with spice and flowers, had shocked his every sense. It had felt almost like an assault, leaving him drowsy and disoriented. And while his reaction to London wasn't quite that dramatic, he still felt rather like the odd man out, his senses buffeted by smells and sounds that shouldn't have felt so unfamiliar. Had he become a stranger in his own land? It seemed almost bizarre. And yet, as he walked along the crowded streets of London's most exclusive shopping district, he couldn't help but think that he stood out, that anyone glancing upon him must instantly know that he was different, removed from their very British existence. Or, he allowed, as he caught sight of his reflection in a shop window, it could be the tan. It would take weeks to fade. Months, maybe. His mother was going to be scandalized. The thought of it made him grin. He rather enjoyed scandalizing his mother. He'd never be so grown up that that ceased to be fun. He turned on Bruton Street and walked past the last few homes to number 5. He'd been there before, of course. Francesca's mother had always defined the word family in the widest of all possible manners. So Michael had found himself invited, along with John and Francesca, to any number of Bridgerton family events. When he arrived, Lady Bridgerton was already in the green and cream drawing-room, taking a cup of tea at her writing-desk under the window. "Michael!" she exclaimed, rising to her feet with obvious affection. "How good to see you!"
"Lady Bridgerton," he said, taking her hand and gracing it with a gallant kiss.
"No one does that like you," she said approvingly.
"One has to cultivate one's best manoeuvres," he murmured.
"And I can't tell you how much we ladies of a certain age appreciate your doing so."
"A certain age being..."
He smiled devilishly.
31.
Lady Bridgerton was the sort of woman who grew lovelier with age, but the smile she gave him made her positively radiant. "You are always welcome in this house, Michael Stirling." He grinned and sat in a high-backed chair when she motioned for him to do so. "Oh, dear," she said with a slight frown. "I must apologize. I suppose I should be calling you Kilmartin now."
"Michael is just fine," he assured her.
"I know that it's been 4 years," she continued, "but as I haven't seen you..."
"You may call me anything you wish," he said smoothly.
It was strange. He'd finally grown used to being called Kilmartin, adapted to the way his title had overtaken his surname. But that had been in India, where no one had known him as plain Mr. Stirling, and perhaps more importantly, no one had known John as the Earl. Hearing his title on Violet Bridgerton's lips was a little unnerving, especially since she had, as was the custom for many mothers-in-law, habitually referred to John as her son. But if she sensed any of his inner discomfort, she gave no indication. "If you are going to be so accommodating," she said, "then I must be as well. Please do call me Violet. It's well past time that you did."
"Oh, I couldn't," he said quickly,
and he meant it. This was Lady Bridgerton. She was, well, he didn't know what she was, but she couldn't possibly be Violet to him. "I insist, Michael," she said, "and I'm certain you're already aware that I usually get my way." There was no way he was going to win the argument, so he just sighed and said,
"I don't know if I can kiss the hand of a Violet. It seems rather scandalously intimate, don't you think?"
"Don't you dare stop."
"Tongues will wag," he warned her.
"I believe my reputation can withstand it."
"Ah, but can mine?"
She laughed. "You are a rascal." He leaned back in his chair.
"It serves me well."
"Would you care for tea?" She motioned to the delicate china pot on the desk across the room. "Mine has gone cold, but I would be happy to ring for more."
"I'd love some," he admitted.
"I suppose you're spoiled for it now, after so many years in India," she said, standing and crossing the room to ring the bell pull.
"It's just not the same," he said, quickly rising to his feet as well. "I can't explain it, but nothing tastes quite like tea in England."
"The quality of the water, do you think?" He smiled stealthily.
"The quality of the woman pouring." She laughed.
"You, my lord, need a wife, immediately."
"Oh, really? And why is that?"
"Because in your present state, you are clearly a danger to unmarried women everywhere."
He couldn't resist one last flirtation. "I hope you are including yourself in those ranks, Violet."
And then a voice from the door. "Are you flirting with my mother?" It was Francesca, of course, impeccably turned out in a lavender morning dress, adorned with a rather intricate stretch of Belgian lace. She looked as if she were very much trying to be stern with him, and not entirely succeeding. Michael allowed his lips to curve into a mysterious smile as he watched the two ladies take their seats.
"I have travelled the world over, Francesca, and can say without qualification that there are few women with whom I'd rather flirt than your mother."
"I am inviting you to supper right now," Violet announced, "and I will not accept no for an answer."
Michael chuckled.
"I'd be honoured."
Across from him, Francesca murmured,
"You are incorrigible."
He just flashed her a lanky grin. This was good, he decided. The morning was proceeding exactly as he'd hoped, with he and Francesca falling into their old roles and habits. He was once again the reckless charmer, and she was pretending to scold him, and all was as it had been back before John had died. He'd been surprised last night. He hadn't expected to see her, and he hadn't been able to make sure that his public persona was firmly in place. And it wasn't as if it all was an act. He'd always been a bit reckless, and he probably was an irredeemable flirt. His mother certainly liked to say that he'd been charming the ladies since the age of 4. It was just that when he was with Francesca, it was vitally important that that aspect of his personality remained at the forefront, so that she never suspected what lay underneath.
"What are your plans now that you are returned?" Violet asked.
Michael turned to her with what he knew had to be a blank expression.
"I'm not certain, actually," he said,
ashamed to admit to himself that that was true.
"I imagine it will take me some time to understand just what exactly is expected of me in my new role."
"I'm sure Francesca can be of help in that quarter," Violet said.
"Only if she wishes it,"
Michael said quietly.
"Of course,"
Francesca said, moving slightly to the side when a maid came in with a tea tray.
"I will assist you in any way you need."
"That was rather quick," Michael murmured.
"I'm mad for tea," Violet explained. "Drink it all day long. The maids keep water to near boiling on the stove at all times now." "Will you have some?"
Francesca asked, since she had taken charge of pouring.
"Yes, thank you," Michael replied.
"No one knows Kilmartin as Francesca does," Violet said, with all the pride of a mother hen. "She will prove invaluable to you."
"I am quite sure that you are correct," Michael said,
accepting a cup from Francesca. She had remembered how he took it. Milk, no sugar. For some reason, this pleased him immensely.
"She has been the Countess for 6 years, and for 4 of them she has had to be the Earl as well."
At Francesca's startled glance, he added,
"In every way but in name." "Oh, come now, Francesca, you must realise that it is true."
And,
he added, "that it is a compliment. I owe you a greater debt than I could ever repay. I could not have stayed away so long had I not known that the earldom was in such capable hands."
Francesca actually blushed, which surprised him. In all the years he'd known her, he could count on one hand the times he had seen her cheeks go pink.
"Thank you," she mumbled. "It was no difficulty, I assure you."
"Perhaps, but it is appreciated all the same."
He lifted his teacup to his lips, allowing the ladies to direct the conversation from there, which they did. Violet asked him about his time in India, and before he knew it, he was telling them of palaces and princesses, caravans and curries. He left out the marauders and malaria, and deciding they weren't quite the thing for a drawing-room conversation. After a while, he realised that he was enjoying himself immensely. Maybe, he thought, reflecting on the moment, as Violet said something about an Indian-themed ball she'd attended the year before, just maybe he'd made the right decision. It might actually be good to be home. An hour later, Francesca found herself on Michael's arm, strolling through Hyde Park. The sun had broken through the clouds, and when she had declared that she could not resist the fine weather, Michael had had no choice but to offer to accompany her for a walk.
"It's rather like old times," she said, tilting her face up toward the sun.
She'd most likely end up with a ghastly tan, or at the very least freckles. But she supposed she'd always look like pale porcelain next to Michael, whose skin marked him immediately as a recent returnee from the tropics.
"Walking, you mean?" he asked. "Or you're expertly manoeuvring me into accompanying you?"
She tried to maintain a straight face.
"Both, of course. You used to take me out a great deal, whenever John was busy."
"So I did."
They walked on in silence for a few moments, and then he said,
"I was a bit surprised to find you gone this morning."
"I hope you understand why I had to leave," she said. "I didn't want to, of course. Returning to my mother's home makes me feel as if I'm stepping right back into childhood."
She felt her lips pinching together in distaste.
"I adore her, of course, but I've grown rather used to maintaining my own household."
"Would you like me to take up residence elsewhere?"
"No, of course not," she said quickly. "You are the Earl. Kilmartin House belongs to you. Besides, Helen and Janet are only a week behind me. They should arrive soon, and then I will be able to move back in."
"Chin up, Francesca. I'm sure you will endure."
She shot him a sideways glance.
"It is nothing that you, or any man for that matter, will understand, but I much prefer my status as a married woman to that of a debutante. When I'm at Number 5, with both Eloise and Hyacinth in residence, I feel as if I'm back in my first season, with all the attendant rules and regulations."
"Not all of them," he pointed out. "If that were true, you'd not be allowed out with me right now."
"True," she acceded. "Especially with you, I imagine."
"And just what is that supposed to mean?"
She laughed.
"Oh, come now, Michael. Did you really think that your reputation would find itself whitewashed just because you left the country for 4 years?
"Francesca!"
"You're a legend."
He looked aghast.
"It's true,"
she said, wondering why he was so surprised.
"Goodness, women are still talking about you."
"Not to you, I hope," he muttered.
"Oh, to me above all others."
She grinned wickedly.
"They all want to know when you plan to return, and it's sure to be worse once word gets out that you're back. I must say, it's rather an odd role, confidant to London's most notorious rake."
"Confidant, eh?"
"What else would you call it?"
"No, no. Confidant is a perfectly appropriate word. It's just that if you think I've confided everything in you..."
Francesca shot him a cross expression. This was so like him, letting his words trail off meaningfully, leaving her imagination feverish with questions.
"I take it, then," she muttered, "that you did not share with us all the news from India?"
He just smiled, devilishly.
"Very well. Allow me, then, to move the conversation to more respectable areas. What do you plan to do, now that you are back? Will you take up your seat in Parliament?"
He appeared not to have considered that.
"It is what John would have wanted," she said,
knowing that she was being fiendishly manipulative. Michael looked at her grimly, and his eyes told her that he did not appreciate her tactics.
"You will have to marry as well," Francesca said.
"Do you plan to take on the role of my matchmaker?"
he asked peevishly. She shrugged.
"If you desire it. I'm sure I couldn't possibly do a worse job of it than you."
"Good God," he grumbled. "I've been back 1 day. Do we need to address this now?"
"No, of course not," she allowed. "But soon. You're not getting any younger."
Michael just stared at her in shock.
"I can't imagine permitting anyone else to speak to me in such a manner."
"Don't forget your mother,"
she said, with a satisfied smile.
"You," he said rather forcefully, "are not my mother."
"Thank heavens for that," she returned. "I'd have expired of heart failure years ago. I don't know how she does it."
He actually halted in his tracks.
"I'm not that bad."
She shrugged delicately.
aren't you?"
And he was speechless, absolutely speechless. It was a conversation they'd had countless times, but something was different now. There was an edge to her voice, a jab to her words that had never quite been there before. Or maybe it was just that he'd never noticed it.
"Oh, don't look so shocked, Michael,"
she said, reaching across her body and patting him lightly on the arm.
"Of course you have a terrible reputation, but you are endlessly charming, and so you are always forgiven."
Was this how she saw him, he wondered? And why was he surprised? It was exactly the image he'd cultivated.
"And now that you are the Earl," she continued, "the mamas shall be falling all over themselves to pair you with their precious daughters."
"I feel afraid," he said under his breath. "Very afraid."
"You should,"
she said, with no sympathy whatsoever.
"It will be a feeding frenzy, I assure you. You were fortunate that I took my mother aside this morning and made her swear not to throw Eloise or Hyacinth in your path. She would do it too,"
she added, clearly relishing the conversation. "I seem to recall that you used to find joy in throwing your sisters in my path." Her lips twisted slightly.
"That was years ago,"
she said, swishing her hand through the air as if she could wave his words away on the wind.
"You would never suit."
He'd never had any desire to court either of her sisters, but nor could he resist the chance to give Francesca a wee verbal poke. "Eloise?" he queried. "Or Hyacinth?"
"Neither,"
she replied, with enough testiness to make him smile.
"But I shall find you someone. Do not fret."
"Was I fretting?" She went on as if he hadn't spoken.
"I think I shall introduce you to Eloise's friend, Penelope."
"Miss Featherington?" he asked, vaguely recalling a slightly pudgy girl who never spoke.
"She's my friend as well, of course," Francesca added. "I believe you might like her."
"Has she learned to speak?" She glared at him.
"I'm going to ignore that comment. Penelope is a perfectly lovely and highly intelligent lady, once one gets past her initial shyness."
"And how long does that take?" he muttered.
"I think she would balance you quite nicely," Francesca declared.
"Francesca," he said, somewhat forcefully, "you will not play matchmaker for me. Is that understood?"
"Well, some..."
"And don't you say that someone has to," he cut in. Really, she was the same open book she'd been years ago. She'd always wanted to manage his life.
"Michael,"
she said, the word coming out as a sigh that was far more long-suffering than she had a right to be. "I have been back in town for one day," he said. "One day. I am tired, and I don't care if the sun is out. I'm still bloody cold, and my belongings haven't even been unpacked. Pray give me at least a week before you start planning my wedding."
"A week, then," she said slyly.
"Francesca," he said, his voice laced with warning.
"Very well," she said dismissively. "But don't you dare say I didn't warn you. Once you are out in society, and the young ladies have you backed into a corner with their mamas coming in for the kill..."
He shuddered at the image, and at the knowledge that her prediction was probably correct.
"You will be begging for my help,"
she finished, looking up at him with a rather annoyingly satisfied expression. "I'm sure I will," he said, giving her a paternalistic smile that he knew she'd detest. "And when that happens, I promise you that I shall be duly prostrate with regretfulness, atonement, shamefacedness, and any other unpleasant emotion you care to assign to me." And then she laughed, which warmed his heart far more than he should have let it. He could always make her laugh. She turned to him and smiled, then patted his arm.
"It's good to have you back."
"It's good to be back," he said. He'd said the words automatically, but he realized he'd meant them. It was good. Difficult, but good. But even difficult wasn't worth complaining over. It was certainly nothing he wasn't used to. They were fairly deep in Hyde Park now, and the grounds were growing a bit more crowded. The trees were only just beginning to bud, but the air was still nippy enough that the people out strolling weren't looking for shade.
"I should have brought bread for the birds," Francesca murmured.
"At the Serpentine?" Michael asked with surprise. He'd often walked in Hyde Park with Francesca, and they had tended to avoid that area of the Serpentine's banks like the plague. It was always full of nursemaids and children, shrieking like little savages, often the nursemaids more so than the children, and Michael had at least one acquaintance who had found himself pelted in the head with a loaf of bread. Seems no one had told the budding little cricket player that one was supposed to break the bread into more manageable and less hazardous segments.
"I like to toss bread in for the birds," Francesca said, a touch defensively. "Besides, there won't be too many children about today. It's still a bit cold yet."
"Never stopped John and me," Michael offered gamely.
"Yes, well, you're Scottish," she returned. "Your blood circulates quite well, half-frozen."
He grinned. "A hearty lot, we Scots." It was a bit of a joke, that. With so much intermarriage, the family was at least as much English as it was Scottish, perhaps even more so. But with Kilmartin firmly situated in the border counties, the Stirlings clung to their Scottish heritage like a badge of honour. They found a bench not too far from the Serpentine and sat, idly watching the ducks on the water.
"You'd think they'd find a warmer spot," Michael said. "France, maybe."
"And miss out on all the food the children toss at them?"
Francesca smiled wryly.
"They're not stupid."
He just shrugged. Far be it from him to pretend any great knowledge of avian behaviour.
"How did you find the climate in India?" Francesca queried. "Is it as hot as they say?"
"More so," he replied. "Or maybe not. I don't know. I imagine the descriptions are perfectly accurate. The problem is, no Englishman can truly understand what they mean until he gets there." She looked at him quizzically. "It's hotter than you could ever imagine," he said, spelling it out.
"It sounds... well, I don't know how it sounds," she admitted.
"The heat isn't nearly so difficult as the insects."
"It sounds dreadful," Francesca decided.
"You probably wouldn't like it. Not for an extended stay, anyway."
"I'd like to travel, though," she said softly. "I'd always planned to."
She fell silent, nodding in a rather absent-minded manner, her chin tilting up and down for so long that he was quite sure she'd forgotten she was doing it. Then he realised that her eyes were fixed off in the distance. She was watching something, but for the life of him, he couldn't imagine what. There was nothing interesting in the vista. Just a pinch-faced nursemaid pushing a pram. "What are you looking at?" he finally asked. She said nothing, just continued to stare.
"Francesca."
She turned to him.
"I want a baby."
Chapter 7.
"Had hoped to have received a note from you by now, but of course the post is notoriously unreliable when it must travel so far. Just last week, I heard tale of the arrival of a mail pouch that was a full 2 years old. Many of the recipients had already returned to England. My mother writes that you are well and fully recovered from your ordeal. I am glad to hear of it. My work here continues to challenge and fulfil. I have taken up residence outside the city proper, as do most Europeans here in Madras. Nonetheless, I enjoy visiting the city. It is rather Grecian in appearance, or rather what I must imagine is Grecian, having never visited that country myself. The sky is blue, so blue it is nearly blinding, almost the bluest thing I have ever seen." From the Earl of Kilmartin to the Countess of Kilmartin, 6 months after his arrival in India. "I beg your pardon?"
She'd shocked him. He was sputtering even. She hadn't made her announcement to elicit this sort of reaction, but now that he was sitting there, his mouth hanging open and slack, she couldn't help but take a small amount of pleasure from the moment.
"I want a baby," she said with a shrug. "Is there something surprising in that?"
His lips moved before he actually made sound.
"Well, no, but..."
"I'm 26.
"I know how old you are," he said, a little testily.
"I'll be 27 at the end of April. I don't think it's so odd that I might want a child."
His eyes still held a vaguely glazed sort of quality.
"No, of course not, but..."
"And I shouldn't have to explain myself to you."
"I wasn't asking you to,"
he said, staring at her as if she'd grown two heads.
"I'm sorry," she mumbled. "I overreacted."
He said nothing, which irritated her. At the very least, he could have contradicted her. It would have been a lie, but it was still the kind and courteous thing to do. Finally, because the silence was simply unbearable, she muttered,
"A lot of women want children."
"Right," he said, coughing on the word. "Of course. But don't you think you might want a husband first?"
"Of course."
She speared him with an aggravated glare.
"Why do you think I came down to London early?"
He looked at her blankly.
"I am shopping for a husband,"
she said, speaking to him as if he were a half-wit.
"How mercenarily put," he murmured.
She pursed her lips.
"It's what it is, and you had probably best get used to it for your own sake. It's precisely how the ladies will soon be talking about you."
He ignored the latter part of her statement.
"Do you have a particular gentleman in mind?"
She shook her head.
"Not yet. I imagine someone will pop to the forefront once I start looking, though."
She was trying to sound jolly about it, but the truth was, her voice was dropping in both tone and volume.
"I'm sure my brothers have friends,"
she finally mumbled. He looked at her, then slumped back slightly and stared at the water.
"I've shocked you,"
she said.
"Well, yes."
"Normally I'd take great pleasure in that,"
she said, her lips twisting ironically. He didn't reply, but he did roll his eyes slightly.
"I can't mourn John forever," she said. "I mean, I can, and I will, but..."
She stopped, hating that she was near tears.
"And the worst part of it is, maybe I can't even have children. It took me 2 years to conceive with John, and look how I mucked that up."
"Francesca," he said fiercely, "you mustn't blame yourself for the miscarriage."
She let out a bitter laugh.
"Can you imagine marrying someone just so I could have a baby, and then not having one?"
"It happens to people all the time,"
he said softly. It was true, but it didn't make her feel any better. She had a choice. She didn't have to marry. She would be quite well provided for, and blessedly independent, if she remained a widow. If she married... no, when she married, she had to mentally commit to the idea. It wouldn't be for love. She wasn't going to have a marriage like the one she'd shared with John. A woman simply didn't find love like that twice in a lifetime. She was going to marry for a baby, and there was no guarantee that she would get one.
"Francesca."
She didn't look at him, just sat there and blinked, desperately trying to ignore the tears burning at the corners of her eyes. Michael held out a handkerchief, but she didn't want to acknowledge the gesture. If she took the cloth, then she'd have to cry. There would be nothing stopping her.
"I must move on,"
she said defiantly.
"I must. John is gone, and I..."
And then the strangest thing happened. Except strange wasn't really the right word. Shocking, perhaps, or altering. Or maybe there wasn't a word for the type of surprise that stole the pulse from one's body, leaving one immobile, unable to breathe. She turned to him. It should have been a simple thing. She'd certainly turned to Michael before. Hundreds, no, thousands of times. He might have spent the last 4 years in India, but she knew his face, and she knew his smile. In truth, she knew everything about him. Except this time was different. She turned to him, but she hadn't expected him to have already turned to her. And she hadn't expected him to be so close that she'd see the charcoal flecks in his eyes. But most of all, she hadn't expected her gaze to drop to his lips. They were full and lush and finely moulded, and she knew the shape as well as the shape of her own. Except never before had she really looked at them, noticed the way they weren't quite uniform in colour, or how the curve of his lower lip was really quite sensual. And she stood, so quickly that she nearly lost her balance.
"I have to go,"
she said, stunned that her voice sounded like her own and not some freakish demon.
"I have an appointment. I'd forgotten."
"Of course," he said, standing beside her.
"With the dressmaker,"
she added, as if details would make her lie more convincing.
"All my clothes are in half-mourning colours."
He nodded.
"They don't suit you."
"Kind of you to point it out," she said testily.
"You should wear blue,"
he said. She nodded jerkily, still off balance and out of sorts.
"Are you all right?" he asked.
"I'm fine,"
she bit off. And then, because no one would ever have been fooled by her tone, she added more carefully,
"I'm fine, I assure you. I simply detest being tardy."
That much was true, and he knew it of her. So hopefully he'd accept it as reason for her snappishness.
"Very well,"
he said congenially, and Francesca chattered all the way back to number 5. She had to put up a good front, she realised rather feverishly. She couldn't possibly allow him to guess what had really transpired within her on the bench by the Serpentine. She had known, of course, that Michael was handsome, even startlingly so, but it had all been an abstract sort of knowledge. Michael was handsome, just as her brother Benedict was tall, and her mother had beautiful eyes. But now, she'd looked at him, and she'd seen something entirely new. She'd seen a man, and it scared the very devil out of her. Francesca tended to subscribe to the notion that the best course of action was more action, so when she returned to number 5 after her stroll, she sought out her mother and informed her that she needed to visit the modiste immediately, best to make truth out of her lie as soon as possible after all. Her mother was only too delighted to see Francesca out of her half-mourning greys and lavenders, and so barely an hour passed before the two of them were comfortably ensconced in Violet's elegant carriage, on their way to the exclusive shops on Bond Street. Normally, Francesca would have bristled at Violet's interference. She was perfectly capable of picking out her own wardrobe, thank you very much. But today she found her mother's presence oddly comforting. Not that her mother wasn't usually a comfort, just that Francesca tended to favour her independent streak more often than not, and she rather preferred not to be thought of as one of those Bridgerton girls. And in a very strange way, this trip to the dressmaker was rather discomforting. It would have required full-fledged torture to get her to admit it, but Francesca was, quite simply, terrified. Even if she hadn't decided it was time to remarry, shrugging off her widow's weeds signalled a huge change, and not one she was entirely sure she was ready for. She looked down at her sleeve as she sat in the carriage. She couldn't see the fabric of her dress. It was covered by her coat, but she knew that it was lavender. And there was something comforting in that, something solid and dependable. She'd worn that colour, or grey in its place, for 3 years now, and unrelenting black for a year before that. It had been a bit of a badge, she realised, a uniform of sorts. One never had to worry about who one was when one's clothing proclaimed it so loudly.
"Mother,"
she said, before she even realised that she had a question to ask. Violet turned to her with a smile.
"Yes, dear." "Why did you never remarry?"
Violet's lips parted slightly, and to Francesca's great surprise, her eyes grew bright.
"Do you know,
Violet said softly. "This is the first time any of you has asked me that."
"That can't be true," Francesca said. "Are you certain?"
Violet nodded.
"None of my children has asked me. I would have remembered." "No, no, of course you would," Francesca said quickly. "But it was all so odd and unthinking, really. Why would no one have asked Violet about this?"
It seemed to Francesca quite the most burning question imaginable. And even if none of Violet's children had cared about the answer for their own personal curiosity, didn't they realize how important it was to Violet?
Didn't they want to know their mother? Truly know her? "When your father died," Violet said, "well, I don't know how much you recall, but it was very sudden. None of us expected it."
She gave a sad little laugh, and Francesca wondered if she'd ever be able to laugh about John's death, even if it was tinged with grief.
"A bee sting,"
Violet continued, and Francesca realized that even now, more than 20 years after Edmund Bridgerton's death, her mother still sounded surprised when she talked about it.
"Who would have thought it possible?" Violet said, shaking her head. "I don't know how well you remember him, but your father was a very large man, as tall as Benedict, and perhaps even broader in the shoulders. You just wouldn't think that a bee..."
She stopped, pulling out a crisp white handkerchief and holding it to her lips as she cleared her throat.
"Well, it was unexpected. I don't really know what else to say, except..."
She turned to her daughter with achingly wise eyes.
"Except I imagine you understand better than anyone."
Francesca nodded, not even trying to stem the burning sensation behind her eyes.
"Anyway," Violet said briskly, obviously eager to move forward, "after his death, I was just so stunned. I felt as if I were walking in a haze. I'm not at all certain how I functioned that first year, or even the ones directly thereafter. So I couldn't possibly even think of marriage."
"I know," Francesca said softly, and she did.
"And after that, well, I don't know what happened. Maybe I just didn't meet anyone with whom I cared to share my life. Maybe I loved your father too much."
She shrugged.
"Maybe I just never saw the need. I was in a very different position from you, after all. I was older, don't forget, and already the mother of 8 children. And your father left our affairs in very good order. I knew we would never want for anything." "John left Kilmartin in excellent order," Francesca said quickly.
"Of course he did," Violet said, patting her hand.
"Forgive me. I did not mean to imply otherwise. But you don't have 8 children, Francesca."
Her eyes changed somehow, grew an even deeper blue.
"And you've quite a lot of time ahead of you to spend it all alone."
Francesca nodded jerkily.
"I know," she said. "I know, I know. But I can't quite... I can't..."
"You can't what?" Violet asked gently.
"I can't..."
Francesca looked down. She didn't know why, but for some reason she couldn't take her eyes off the floor.
"I can't rid myself of the feeling that I'm doing something wrong, that I'm dishonouring John, dishonouring our marriage."
"John would have wanted you to be happy."
"I know, I know. Of course he would. But don't you see?"
She looked up again, her eyes searching her mother's face for something. She wasn't sure what. Maybe approval, maybe just love, since there was something comforting in looking for something she already knew she'd find.
"I'm not even looking for that," she added. "I'm not going to find someone like John. I've accepted that, and it feels so wrong to marry with less."
"You won't find someone like John, that is true," Violet said. "But you might find a man who will suit you equally well, just in a different way."
"You didn't?"
"No, I didn't," she agreed,
but I didn't look very hard. I didn't look at all. Do you wish you had?
Violet opened her mouth, but not a sound came out, not even breath. Finally, she said,
I don't know, Francesca.
I honestly don't know. And then, because the moment almost certainly needed a bit of laughter, she added, I certainly didn't want any more children. Francesca couldn't help but smile.
I do,
she said, softly.
I want a baby.
I thought that you did.
Why did you never ask me about it?
Violet tilted her head to the side.
Why did you never ask me about why I never remarried?
Francesca felt her lips part. She shouldn't have been so surprised by her mother's perceptiveness.
If you had been Eloise, I think I would have said something,
Violet added, or any of your sisters, for that matter.
But you,
she smiled nostalgically,
you're not the same.
You never have been. Even as a child, you set yourself apart,
and you needed your distance.
Impulsively, Francesca reached out and squeezed her mother's hand.
I love you. Did you know that?
Violet smiled.
I rather suspected it. Mother, very well.
Of course I knew it.
How could you not love me when I love you so very, very much?
I haven't said it, Francesca said, feeling rather horrified by her omission.
Not recently, anyway.
It's quite all right. Violet squeezed her hand back. You've had other things on your mind. And for some reason, that made Francesca giggle under her breath.
A bit of an understatement, I should say.
Violet just grinned.
Mother,
Francesca blurted out,
may I ask you one more question?
Of course.
If I don't find someone, not like John, of course, but still not equally suited to me, if I don't find someone like that, and I marry someone whom I rather like, but perhaps don't love, is that all right?
Violet was silent for several moments before she answered. I'm afraid only you will know the answer to that, she finally said.
I would never say no, of course. Half the ton, more than half, in truth, has marriages like that, and quite a few of them are perfectly content.
But you will have to make your judgments for yourself when they arise.
Everyone is different, Francesca. I suspect you know that better than most.
And when a man asks for your hand, you will have to judge him on his merits, and not by some arbitrary standard you have set out ahead of time. She was right, of course, but Francesca was so sick of life being messy and complicated that it wasn't the answer she'd been seeking, and none of it addressed the problem that lay most deeply within her heart. What would happen if she actually did meet someone who made her feel the way she'd felt with John? She couldn't imagine that she would. Truly, it seemed wildly improbable. But what if she did? How could she live with herself then? There was something rather satisfying about a foul mood, so Michael decided to indulge his completely. He kicked a pebble all the way home. He snarled at anyone who jostled him on the street. He yanked open his front door with such ferocity that it slammed into the stone wall behind it. Or rather, he would have done, if his sodding butler hadn't been so on his toes and had the door open before Michael's fingers could even touch the handle. But he thought about slamming it open, which provided some satisfaction in and of itself. And then he stomped up the stairs to his room, which still felt too bloody much like John's room, not that there was anything he could do about that just then, and yanked off his boots, or tried to. Bloody hell!
Rivas!
He bellowed. His valet appeared, or really it seemed rather more like he apparated in the doorway.
Yes, my lord. Would you help me with my boots?
Michael ground out, feeling rather infantile. 3 years in the army and 4 in India, and he couldn't remove his own damned boots. What was it about London that reduced a man to a snivelling idiot? He seemed to recall that Reavers had had to remove his boots for him the last time he'd lived in London as well. He looked down. They were different boots. Different styles, he supposed, for different situations. And Reavers had always taken a stunningly ridiculous pride in his work. Of course, he'd have wanted to outfit Michael in the very best of London fashion. He'd have...
"Reavers," Michael said in a low voice, "where did you get these boots?" "My lord, these boots, I do not recognize them. We have not yet received all of your trunks from the ship, my lord. You didn't have anything suitable for London, so I located these among the previous earl's belongings." "Jesus! My lord, I'm terribly sorry if these don't suit you. I remembered that the two of you were of a size, and I thought you'd want—" "Just get them off, now!"
Michael closed his eyes and sat in a leather chair, John's leather chair, marvelling at the irony of it. His worst nightmare coming true, in the most literal of fashions.
"Of course, my lord."
Reavers looked pained, but he quickly went to work removing the boots. Michael pinched the bridge of his nose with his thumb and forefinger and let out a long breath before speaking again.
"I would prefer not to use any items from the previous Earl's wardrobe," he said wearily.
Truly, he had no idea why John's clothing was still here. The lot of it should have been given to the servants or donated to charity years ago. But he supposed that was Francesca's decision to make, not his.
"Of course, my lord. I shall see to it immediately."
"Good," Michael grunted.
"Shall I have it locked away?"
"Locked? Good God. It wasn't as if the stuff were toxic."
"I'm sure it is all just fine where it is," Michael said. "Just don't use any of it for me."
"Right." Reavers swallowed, and his Adam's apple bobbed uncomfortably.
"What is it now, Reavers?" "It's just that all of the previous Lord Kilmartin's accoutrements are still here."
"Here?" Michael asked blankly.
"Here,"
Reavers confirmed, glancing about the room. Michael sagged in his chair. It wasn't that he wanted to wipe every last reminder of his cousin off the face of this earth. No one missed John as much as he did. No one. Well, except maybe Francesca, he allowed. But that was different. But he just didn't know how he was meant to lead his life so completely and smotheringly surrounded by John's belongings. He held his title, spent his money, lived in his house. Was he meant to wear his damned shoes as well?
"Pack it all up," he said to Reavers. "Tomorrow. I don't wish to be disturbed this evening."
And besides, he probably ought to alert Francesca of his intentions. Francesca. He sighed, rising to his feet once the valet had departed. Christ, Reavers had forgotten to take the boots with him. Michael picked them up and deposited them outside the door. He was probably overreacting. But hell, he just didn't want to stare at John's boots for the next 6 hours. After shutting the door with a decisive click, he padded aimlessly over to the window. The sill was wide and deep, and he leaned heavily against it, gazing through the sheer curtains at the blurry streetscape below. He pushed the thin fabric aside, his lips twisting into a bitter smile as he watched a nursemaid tugging a small child along the pavement. Francesca. She wanted a baby. He didn't know why he was so surprised. If he thought about it rationally, he really shouldn't have been. She was a woman, for God's sake. Of course she'd want children. Didn't they all? And while he'd never consciously sat down and told himself that she'd pine away for John forever, he'd also never considered the idea that she might actually care to remarry one day. Francesca and John. John and Francesca. They were a unit. Or at least they had been, and although John's death had made it sadly easy to envision one without the other, it was quite something else entirely to think of one with another. And then, of course, there was the small matter of his skin crawling. which was his general reaction to the thought of Francesca with another man. He shuddered. Or was that a shiver? Damn, he hoped it wasn't a shiver. He supposed he was simply going to have to get used to the notion. If Francesca wanted children, then Francesca needed a husband, and there wasn't a damned thing he could do about it. It would have been rather nice, he supposed, if she had come to this decision and taken care of the whole odious matter last year, sparing him the nausea of having to witness the entire courtship unfold. If she'd just gone and gotten herself married last year, then it would have been over and done with, and that would have been that. End of story. But now he was going to have to watch, maybe even advise. Bloody hell. He shivered again. Damn. Maybe he was just cold. It was March, after all, and a chilly one at that, even with a fire in the grate. He tugged at his cravat, which was starting to feel unaccountably tight, then yanked it off altogether. Christ! He felt like the very devil, all hot and cold and queerly off balance. He sat down. It seemed the best course of action. And then he just gave up all pretense of being well, stripping off the rest of his clothing and crawling into bed. It was going to be a long night. Chapter 8.
Wonderful, lovely, nice. Strike. Good to hear from you. I am glad you were faring well. John would have been proud. I miss you. Strike. I miss him. I miss you. Strike. Some of the flowers are still out. Isn't it nice that some of the flowers are still out?
From the Countess of Kilmartin to the Earl of Kilmartin, 1 week after the receipt of his second missive to her. First draft. Never finished. Never sent.
Didn't Michael say that he would be joining us for supper this evening?
Francesca looked up at her mother, who was standing before her with concerned eyes. She had been thinking the exact same thing, actually, wondering what was keeping him. She'd spent the better part of the day dreading his arrival, even though he had absolutely no idea that she had been so distressed by that moment in the park. Good heavens, he probably didn't even realize there had been a moment. It was the first time in her life that Francesca was thankful for the general obtuseness of men.
"Yes, he did say that he would come,"
she replied, shifting slightly in her chair. She had been waiting for some time now in the drawing-room with her mother and two of her sisters, idly passing the time until their supper-guest arrived.
"Didn't we give him the time?"
Violet asked. Francesca nodded.
I confirmed it with him when he left me here, after our stroll in the park.
She was quite certain of the exchange. She clearly recalled feeling rather sick in her stomach when they had spoken of it. She hadn't wanted to see him again. Not so quickly, anyway. But what could she do? Her mother had issued the invitation.
He's probably just running late, said Hyacinth,
Francesca's youngest sister.
I'm not surprised. His sort is always late.
Francesca turned on her instantly.
What is that supposed to mean?
I've heard all about his reputation.
What has his reputation to do with anything?
Francesca asked testily.
And anyway, what would you know of it? He left England years before you made your bow.
Hyacinth shrugged, jabbing a needle into her extremely untidy embroidery.
People still speak of him,
she said carelessly.
The ladies swoon like idiots at the mere mention of his name, if you must know.
There's no other way to swoon,
put in Eloise, who, although Francesca's elder by precisely 1 year, was still unmarried.
Well, rake he may be,
Francesca said archly,
but he has always been punctual to a fault.
She never could countenance others speaking ill of Michael. She might sigh and moan and belabour his faults, but it was entirely unacceptable that Hyacinth, whose knowledge of Michael was based entirely on rumour and innuendo, would make such a sweeping judgment.
Believe what you will,
Francesca said sharply, because there was no way she was going to allow Hyacinth to have the last word.
"But he would never be late to a supper here. He holds Mother in far too high regard."
"What about his regard for you?"
Hyacinth said. Francesca glared at her sister, who was smirking into her embroidery.
"He..."
No, she wasn't going to do this. She wasn't going to sit here and get into an argument with her younger sister, not when something might actually be wrong. Michael was, for all his wicked ways, faultlessly polite and considerate to the bone, or at least he had always been so in her presence, and he would never have arrived for supper, she glanced up at the mantel clock, over 30 minutes late, not at least without sending word. She stood, briskly smoothing down her dove-grey skirts.
"I am going to kill Martin House," she announced.
"By yourself?" Violet asked.
"By myself," Francesca said firmly. "It is my home, after all. I hardly think that tongues will wag if I stop by for a quick visit."
"Yes, yes, of course," her mother said.
"But don't stay too long." "Mother, I am a widow, and I do not plan to spend the night. I merely intend to inquire as to Michael's welfare. I shall be just fine, I assure you."
Violet nodded, but from her expression, Francesca could see that she would have liked to have said more. It had been like this for years. Violet wanted to resume her role of mother hen to her young widowed daughter, but she held back, attempting to respect her independence. She didn't always manage to resist interfering, but she tried, and Francesca was grateful for the effort.
"Do you want me to accompany you?"
Hyacinth asked, her eyes lighting up.
"No,"
Francesca said, surprise making her tone a bit more vehement than she'd intended it.
"Why on earth would you want to?"
Hyacinth shrugged.
"Curiosity. I'd like to meet the merry rake."
"You've met him,"
Eloise pointed out.
"Yes, but that was ages ago,"
Hyacinth said with a dramatic sigh.
"Before I understood what a rake was."
"You don't understand that now," Violet said sharply.
"Oh, but I..."
"You do not," Violet repeated, "understand what a rake is."
"Very well."
Hyacinth turned to her mother with a sickly, sweet smile.
"I don't know what a rake is. I also don't know how to dress myself or wash my own teeth."
"I did see Polly helping her on with her evening gown last night,"
Eloise murmured from the sofa.
"No one can get into an evening gown on her own,"
Hyacinth shot back.
"I'm leaving,"
Francesca announced, even though she was quite certain no one was listening to her.
"What are you doing?"
Hyacinth demanded. Francesca stopped short until she realized that Hyacinth wasn't speaking to her.
"Just examining your teeth,"
Eloise said sweetly.
"Girls!"
Violet exclaimed, although Francesca couldn't imagine that Eloise took too kindly to the generalization, being 27 as she was. And indeed she didn't, but Francesca took Eloise's irritation and subsequent rejoinder as an opportunity to slip out of the room and ask a footman to call up the carriage for her. The streets were not very crowded. It was early yet, and the ton would not be heading out for parties and balls for at least another hour or two. The carriage moved swiftly through Mayfair, and in under a quarter of an hour, Francesca was climbing the front steps of Kilmartin House in St. James's. As usual, a footman opened the door before she could even lift the knocker, and she hurried inside.
"Is Kilmartin here?"
she asked, realizing with a small jolt of surprise that it was the first time she had referred to Michael as such. It was strange, she realized. And good, really, how naturally it had come to her lips. It was probably past time that they all grew used to the change. He was the Earl now, and he'd never be plain Mr. Stirling again.
"I believe so," the footman replied. "He came in early this afternoon, and I was not made aware of his departure."
Francesca frowned, then gave a nod of dismissal before heading up the steps. If Michael was indeed at home, he must be upstairs. If he were down in his office, the footman would have noticed his presence. She reached the second floor, then strode down the hall toward the Earl's suite, her booted feet silent on the plush Aubusson carpet.
"Michael?" she called out softly as she approached his room. "Michael?"
There was no response, so she moved closer to his door, which she noticed was not quite all the way closed.
"Michael?"
she called again, only slightly louder. It wouldn't do to bellow his name through the house. Besides, if he was sleeping, she didn't wish to wake him. He was probably still tired from his long journey, and had been too proud to indicate as such when Violet had invited him to supper. Still nothing. So she pushed the door open a few additional inches.
"Michael?"
She heard something. A rustle, maybe. Maybe a groan.
"Michael?"
"Franny."
It was definitely his voice, but it wasn't like anything she'd ever heard from his lips.
"Michael?"
She rushed in to find him huddled in his bed, looking quite as sick as she'd ever seen another human being. John, of course, had never been sick. He'd merely gone to bed one evening and woken up dead, so to speak.
"Michael,"
she gasped,
"what is wrong with you?"
"Oh, nothing much," he croaked. "Head cold, I imagine."
Francesca looked down at him with dubious eyes. His dark hair was plastered to his forehead, his skin was flushed and mottled, and the level of heat radiating from the bed quite took her breath away. Not to mention that he smelled sick. It was that awful, sweaty, slightly putrid smell, the sort that, if it had a colour, would surely be vomitous green. Francesca reached out and touched his forehead, recoiling instantly at the heat of it.
"This is not a head cold," she said sharply.
His lips stretched into a hideous approximation of a smile.
"A really bad head cold?"
"Michael Stuart Sterling."
"Good God, you sound like my mother."
She didn't particularly feel like his mother, especially not after what had happened in the park, and it was almost a bit of a relief to see him so feeble and unattractive. It took the edge off whatever it was she'd been feeling earlier that afternoon.
"Michael, what is wrong with you?"
He shrugged, then buried himself deeper under the covers, his entire body shaking from the exertion of it.
"Michael!"
She reached out and grabbed his shoulder. None too gently, either.
"Don't you dare try your usual tricks on me. I know exactly how you operate. You always pretend that nothing matters, that water rolls off your back."
"It does roll off my back," he mumbled. "Yours as well. Simple science, really."
"Michael!" She would have smacked him if he weren't so ill. "You will not attempt to minimize this. Do you understand me? I insist that you tell me right now what is wrong with you."
"I'll be better tomorrow," he said.
"Oh, right,"
Francesca said, with all the sarcasm she could muster, which was, in truth, quite a bit.
"I will,"
he insisted, restlessly shifting positions, every movement punctuated with a groan.
"I'll be fine for tomorrow."
Something about the phrasing of his words struck Francesca as profoundly odd.
"And what about the day after that?"
she asked, her eyes narrowing. A harsh chuckle emerged from somewhere under the covers.
"Why, then I'll be sick as a dog again, of course."
"Michael,"
she said again, dread forcing her voice low,
"what is wrong with you?"
"Haven't you guessed?"
He poked his head back out from under the sheet, and he looked so ill she wanted to cry.
"I have malaria."
"Oh, my God,"
Francesca breathed, actually backing up a step.
"Oh, my God."
"First time I've ever heard you blaspheme," he remarked. "Probably ought to be flattered it's over me."
She had no idea how he could be so flip at such a time.
"Michael, I..."
She reached out, then didn't reach out, unsure of what to do.
"Don't worry," he said,
huddling closer into himself as his body was racked with another wave of shudders.
"You can't catch it from me."
"I can't,"
she blinked.
"I mean, of course I can't."
And even if she could, that ought not have stopped her from nursing him. He was Michael. He was, well, it seemed difficult precisely to define what he was to her, but they had an unbreakable bond, they two, and it seemed that 4 years and thousands of miles had done little to diminish it.
"It's the air," he said in a tired voice. "You have to breathe the putrid air to catch it. It's why they call it malaria. If you could get it from another person, we lot would have infected all of England by now."
She nodded at his explanation.
Are you?
She couldn't ask it. She didn't know how.
"No,"
he said.
"At least they don't think so."
She felt herself sag with relief, and she had to sit down. She couldn't imagine a world without him. Even while he'd been gone, she'd always known he was there, sharing the same planet with her, walking the same earth. And even in those early days following John's death, when she'd hated him for leaving her, even when she'd been so angry with him that she wanted to cry, she had taken some comfort in the knowledge that he was alive and well, and would return to her in an instant, if ever she asked it of him. He was here. He was alive. And with John gone, well, she didn't know how anyone could expect her to lose them both. He shivered again, violently.
"Do you need medicine?"
she asked, snapping to attention.
"Do you have medicine?"
"Took it already,"
he chattered. But she had to do something. She wasn't self-hating enough to think that there had been anything she could have done to prevent John's death. Even in the worst of her grief, she hadn't gone down that road. But she had always hated that the whole thing had happened in her absence. It was, in truth, the one momentous thing John had ever done without her. And even if Michael was only sick and not dying, she was not going to allow him to suffer alone.
"Let me get you another blanket,"
she said. Without waiting for his reply, she rushed through the connecting door to her own suite and pulled the coverlet off her bed. It was rose pink and would most likely offend his masculine sensibilities once he reached a state of sensibility, but that, she decided, was his problem. When she returned to his room, he was so still she thought he'd fallen asleep, but he managed to rouse himself enough to say thank you as she tucked the blanket over him.
"What else can I do?"
she asked, pulling a wooden chair to the side of his bed and sitting down.
"Nothing."
"There must be something,"
she insisted.
"Surely we're not meant to merely wait this out."
"We are meant,"
he said weakly,
"to merely wait this out."
"I can't believe that's true."
He opened one eye.
"Do you mean to challenge the entire medical establishment?"
She ground her teeth together and hunched over in her chair.
"Are you certain you don't need more medicine?"
He shook his head, then moaned at the exertion of it.
"Not for another few hours."
"Where is it?"
she asked. If the only thing she could truly do was to locate the medication and be ready to dispense it, then by God, she would at least do that. He moved his head slightly to the left. Francesca followed the motion toward a small table across the room, where a medicinal bottle sat atop a folded newspaper. She immediately rose and retrieved it, reading the label as she walked back to her chair.
"Quinine," she murmured. "I've heard of that."
"Miracle medicine,"
Michael said,
"or so they say."
Francesca looked at him dubiously.
"Just look at me,"
he said, with a lopsided and feeble grin.
"Proof positive."
She inspected the bottle again, watching the powder shift as she tilted it.
"I remain unconvinced."
One of his shoulders attempted to move in a blithe gesture.
I'm not dead.
That's not funny.
No, it's the only funny thing, he corrected. We've got to take our laughter where we can. Just think, if I died, the title would go to... Oh, how does Janet always put it? That...
awful Debenham side of the family.
They finished together, and Francesca couldn't believe it, but she actually smiled. He could always make her smile. She reached out and took his hand.
We will get through this, she said.
He nodded, and then he closed his eyes. But just when she thought he was asleep, he whispered,
It's better with you here.
The next morning, Michael was feeling somewhat refreshed, and if not quite his usual self, then at least a damn sight better than he'd been the night before. Francesca, he was horrified to realise, was still in the wooden chair at his bedside, her head tilted drunkenly to the side. She looked uncomfortable, in every way a body could look uncomfortable, from the way she was perched in the chair to the awkward angle of her neck and the strange spiral twist of her torso. But she was asleep, snoring even, which she found rather endearing. He'd never pictured her snoring. And sad to say, he had imagined her asleep more times than he cared to count. He supposed it had been too much to hope that he could hide his illness from her. She was far too perceptive, and certainly far too nosy. And even though he would have preferred that she didn't worry over him, the truth was, he'd been comforted by her presence the night before. He shouldn't have been, or at least he shouldn't have allowed himself to be, but he just couldn't help it. He heard her stir and rolled to his side to get a better look. He had never seen her wake up, he realised. He wasn't certain why he found that so strange. It wasn't as if he'd been privy to many of her private moments before. Maybe it was because in all of his daydreams, in all of his fantasies, he'd never quite pictured this, the low rumbling from deep in her throat as she shifted position, the small sigh of sound when she yawned, or even the delicate ballet of her eyelids as they fluttered open. She was beautiful. He'd known that, of course, had known that for years, but never before had he felt it quite so profoundly, quite so deeply in his bones. It wasn't her hair, that rich, lush wave of chestnut that he was rarely so privileged as to see down, and it wasn't even her eyes, so radiantly blue that men had been moved to write poetry. Much, Michael recalled, to John's everlasting amusement. It wasn't even in the shape of her face or the structure of her bones. If that were the case, he'd have been obsessed with the loveliness of all the Bridgerton girls. Such peas in a pod they were, at least on the outside. It was something in the way she moved, something in the way she breathed, something in the way she merely was, and he didn't think he was ever going to get over it. Michael, she murmured, rubbing the sleep from her eyes.
Good morning,
he said, hoping she'd mistake the roughness in his voice for exhaustion.
You look better.
I feel better.
She swallowed and paused before she said,
You're used to this.
He nodded.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that I don't mind the illness, but yes, I'm used to it. I know what to do.
How long will this continue?
It's hard to say. I'll get fevers every other day until I just stop. A week in total, maybe two. Three if I'm fiendishly unlucky.
And then what?
He shrugged.
Then I wait and hope it never happens again.
It can do that?
She sat up straight.
Just never come back?
It's a strange, fickle disease.
Her eyes narrowed.
Don't say it's like a woman.
Hadn't even occurred to me until you brought it up.
Her lips tightened slightly, then relaxed as she asked,
How long has it been since your last?
She blinked.
What do you call them?
He shrugged.
I call them attacks. Certainly feels like one. And it's been 6 months.
Well, that's good.
She caught her lower lip between her teeth.
Isn't it?
Considering it had only been 3 before that, yes, I think so.
How often has this happened?
This is the 3rd time. All in all, it's not too bad compared with what I've seen.
Am I meant to take solace in that?
I do, he said bluntly. Model of Christian virtue that I am.
She reached out abruptly and touched his forehead.
You're much cooler, she remarked.
Yes, I will be. It's a remarkably consistent disease. Well, at least when you're in the midst of it. It would be nice if I knew when I might expect an onset.
And you'll really have another fever in a day's time? Just like that?
Just like that,
he confirmed. She seemed to consider that for a few moments, then said,
You won't be able to hide this from your family, of course.
He actually tried to sit up.
For God's sake, Francesca, don't tell my mother and...
They're expected any day now,
she cut in.
When I left Scotland, they said they would only be a week behind me. And knowing Janet, that really means only 3 days. Do you truly expect them not to notice that you're rather conveniently...
Inconveniently,
he cut in acerbically.
Whichever,
she said sharply.
Do you really think they won't notice that you're sick as death every other day? For heaven's sake, Michael, do credit them with a bit of intelligence.
Very well,
he said, slumping back against the pillows.
But no one else. I have no wish to become the freak of London.
You're hardly the first person to be stricken with malaria.
I don't want anyone's pity, he bit off. Most especially yours.
She drew back as if struck.
And of course he felt like an ass.
Forgive me, he said. That came out wrong.
She glared at him.
I don't want your pity, he said repentantly, but your care and your good wishes are most welcome.
Her eyes didn't meet his, but he could tell that she was trying to decide if she believed him.
I mean it, he said,
and he didn't have the energy to try to cover the exhaustion in his voice.
I am glad you were here. I have been through this before.
She looked over sharply, as if she were asking a question. But for the life of him, he didn't know what.
I have been through this before, he said again, and this time was different, better, easier.
He let out a long breath, relieved to have found the correct word.
Easier. It was easier.
Oh.
She shifted in her chair.
I'm glad.
He glanced over at the windows. They were covered with heavy drapes, but he could see glimmers of sunlight peeking in around the sides.
Won't your mother be worried about you?
Oh, no!
Francesca yelped, jumping to her feet so quickly that her hand slammed into the bedside table.
Ow, ow, ow!
Are you all right?
Michael inquired politely, since it was quite clear she'd done herself no real harm.
Oh!
She was shaking her hand out, trying to stem the pain.
I'd forgotten all about my mother. She was expecting me back last night.
Didn't you send her a note?
I did,
she said.
I told her you were ill, but she wrote back and said she would stop by in the morning to offer her assistance. What time is it? Do you have a clock? Of course you have a clock.
She turned frantically to the small mantel clock over the fireplace. It had been John's room. It still was John's room, in so many ways. Of course she'd know where the clock was.
Oh, it's only 8,
she said with a relieved sigh.
Mother never rises before 9, unless there is an emergency, and hopefully she won't count this as one. I tried not to sound too panicked in my note.
Knowing Francesca, it would have been worded with all the cool-headed calmness she was known for. Michael smiled. She'd probably lied and said she'd hired a nurse.
"There's no need to panic," he said.
She turned to him with agitated eyes.
"You said you didn't want anyone to know you had malaria."
His lips parted. He had never dreamed that she would hold his wishes quite so close to her heart.
"You would keep this from your mother?" he asked softly.
"Of course. It is your decision to tell her, not mine."
It was really quite touching. Rather tender, even.
"I think you're insane," she added sharply.
Well, maybe tender wasn't quite the right word.
"But I will honour your wishes."
She planted her hands on her hips and regarded him with what could only be described as vexation.
"How could you even think I would do otherwise?"
"I have no idea," he murmured.
"Really, Michael," she grumbled, "I do not know what is wrong with you."
"Swampy air,"
he tried to joke. She shot him a look, capitalized.
"I'm going back to my mother's," she said,
pulling on her short grey boots.
"If I don't, you can be sure she will show up here with the entire faculty of the Royal College of Physicians in tow."
He lifted a brow.
"Is that what she did whenever you took ill?"
She let out a little sound that was half snort, half grunt, and all irritation.
"I will be back soon. Don't go anywhere."
He lifted his hands, gesturing somewhat sarcastically to the sickbed.
"Well, I wouldn't put it past you," she muttered.
"Your faith in my superhuman strength is touching."
She paused at the door.
"I swear, Michael, you make the most annoying, deathly ill patient I have ever met."
"I live to entertain you,"
he called out as she was walking down the hall, and he was quite certain that if she'd had something to throw at the door, she would have done so with great vigour. He settled back down against his pillows and smiled. He might make an annoying patient, but she was a crotchety nurse, which was just fine with him.